This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Life is full of what ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? United Healthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
When Diplomacy Fails presents The July Crisis Anniversary Project, a day-by-day account of the events that occurred 100 years ago. Sazonov's Deception. Today is the 26th of July 2014, and on this day in history 100 years ago, occurred the following events. In the early hours of Sunday, the 26th of July, Russia's period preparatory to war was underway in European Russia. Although the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Sazonov, had previously claimed that Russia wouldn't mobilize until Austria attacked Serbia, Russia was in fact undertaking a definite step towards the commencement of hostilities. The major architect behind these moves was the Russian Foreign Minister. A man once upheld as too timid, too unwilling to act, whose track record of inaction during the Balkan Wars had lulled Austro-Hungarian statesmen into a false sense of security. Sergei Sazonov, by summer 1914, was a man of a different form altogether than the one Vienna thought it was dealing with. When the French president had visited in the days before, he had heard rumours about Sazonov's weaknesses, and he had been told by some belligerent Montenegrin princesses about the foreign minister's apparent spinelessness and inability to take a strong stand. President Poincaré, at the time, had hoped that Sazonov's shortcomings could be offset by the strength and convictions of the Tsar. Yet it was Sazonov who operated on a level never before seen in his character. Now that he had gained approval for this course of action, and now that the Tsar had given his blessing for the period preparatory to war, mobilization in Russia's key western districts could begin. And it was up to Sazonov and other key Russian officials to maintain the facade of Russian inaction until the moment was right. The German ambassador to Russia, Friedrich Portelet, had been hearing troubling rumours about Russian preparations, though, and such rumours refused to go away. In fact, it had been the day before when one Russian official had explained to his German friend, present at the scheduled parade, that he had to leave to prepare for the mobilization. When this German friend had recalled the brief conversation to German agents in its embassy, eyebrows began to rise. Was Russia mobilizing? And if it was, why was it doing so in secret? These were the questions that the German ambassador hoped to address when he happened to meet Sazonov as the latter waited at the train station in St. Petersburg to get a ride back to his workplace in town. Sazonov invited the German along for the short trip, and Portelet acquiesced. The last time they had met, on Friday the 24th, the atmosphere had been fraught with tension and tempers had boiled over, the high point being Portelet's accusations against Sazonov that the latter hated Austria. This time, though, the mood seemed far more relaxed. Sazonov was all smiles as he sat with Portelet for the short journey. He was, Portelet later reported home, far more calm and conciliatory. and Sazonov had, insisted with great warmth that Russia was as far as possible from wanting war. Portelet made haste to tell the Russian that Germany felt the same way, and wished to emphasize that Austria didn't want war also. If the Austrians were really seeking, as Portelet says he described it, a pretext to come to blows with Serbia, we would already be hearing now of military action. Since the ultimatum had expired and no word reached Berlin of immediate Austrian action, Portelet could justifiably claim that the situation was not past saving. He urged Sazonov to begin talks with Count Zapary, the Habsburg ambassador to Russia, as soon as possible, and Sazonov said that he would. Sazonov opened the meeting between himself and the Hungarian count by apologizing for losing his temper on the previous Friday, when the two had discussed the ultimatum and tempers had again ran high. Zapary wanted to emphasize in plain terms that his country was far from wishing to push forward into Balkan territory and to begin a march to Salonika or even to Constantinople. Vienna's aim, Zapary explained, was self-preservation and self-defense. Though the Hungarian did understand that complications might arise from the delivery of such an ultimatum, he attempted to persuade Sazonov that interference was not necessary. If a conflict between the great powers arose, he told Sazonov, the consequences would be fearful, and then the religious, moral, and social order of the world would be at stake. In glaring colours, I set forth a notion of what might follow if a European war broke out. Zapary, in his report home to Berchtold, the Austro-Hungarian foreign minister, said that Sazonov agreed with me thoroughly and seemed uncommonly pleased with the report of my explanations. Sazonov then took the floor, and Zapary's report continues to record what he said. Sazonov conceded that in Russia there were old grievances against Austria, and admitted that he had them too. An interesting admission considering his claim to Portelet on the previous Friday that he felt merely contempt for Austria. Sazonov claimed that such feelings belonged to the past, though, and shocked Zapary by claiming that he had no sympathy at all for the Balkan Slavs, who had become a heavy burden for Russia. Russia was, Sazonov explained, willing to consider the Austrian case vis-a-vis the ultimatum and Serbian guilt. But Zapary recorded that Sazonov considered the path we were pursuing to attain it not the safest way. Sazonov continued with his own analysis of the Austrian ultimatum, which focused on points 5 and 6 that had proven so controversial before. Sazonov said that in the event that Belgrade accepted the terms, King Peter would run the risk of being killed at once. A reference to the volatile nature of Serb politics and the rousing nationalist anger that would ensue should the Serb government be perceived of giving in to the Habsburg enemy. Sazonov claimed that such a murder would make the whole situation worse, because it would set up an anarchistic witch's cauldron on Austria's doorstep. Sazonov attempted to modify the ultimatum and tried to change the phraseology of certain points, but Zapary recorded that he couldn't continue since he wasn't authorized to modify the note. He said he would get back to Vienna on Sazonov's intentions, while Zapary says that Sazonov, again in the warmest words, expressed his pleasure at the explanations which I had given him, and which had materially calmed him. He would also, he said, make a report of our conversation to Tsar Nicholas, whom he would see the day after tomorrow. Was Sazonov, the most ardent architect of Russia's mobilization and its period preparatory to war, now having second thoughts? Zapary certainly thought so. In his report back to Berchtold that afternoon, Zapary noted that Russian policy has travelled a long distance in 2 days, from the first rude rejection of our procedure, and from the proposition for a judicial investigation of our dossier, making a European question out of the whole affair, and from that point on again to a recognition of the legitimacy of our claims, and to a request for mediators. It was indeed a transformation. Sazonov continued to suggest he had changed his mind when he wired a request to the Russian ambassador in Vienna and asked that the latter organize a way for Zapary to be given the authority to modify the ultimatum so that their next chat could perhaps produce more concrete results. Though both the German and Austrian ambassadors were aware of the air of goodwill now emanating out of Sazonov's office, they were also noting with alarm the report coming in that suggested Russian mobilization was underway, and that it was preparing itself for war. Can confirm with certainty that mobilization has been ordered in Kiev and Odessa, Warsaw and Moscow possibly, the other districts probably not yet, was the report from the German military attaché that Portelet received, and the German ambassador sent this to Berlin at 3 p.m. Zapary, meanwhile, wired off a note to Berchtold that "We must not overlook the fact that, along with this backing water policy on the part of the diplomats, there is setting in a lively activity on the part of the militarists." Portelet and Zapary were, of course, unaware that it had been the now warm and friendly Sazonov who had orchestrated the mobilization across European Russia. But had they known, they would have been even more concerned for the genuine Russian position. Reports coming in were sketchy, but there was no doubt in Berlin by Sunday afternoon that Russia had some kind of mobilization plan underway. In response to this escalation of events, the German ambassador to Britain, Lichnowsky, lodged a formal complaint with Sir Edward Grey, the Foreign Secretary. However, Grey was too busy fly fishing to take notice of work. He had gone for a break in his estate the night before, no doubt eager to have a rest from the Irish question. Grey's undersecretary, Sir Arthur Nicholson, thus accepted Lichnowsky's complaint, and in his report back to Grey, noted that Prince Lichnowsky called this afternoon with an urgent telegram from his government to say that they had received information that Russia was calling in classes of reserves, which meant mobilization. Lichnowsky even tried to appease Russian sentiments in his appeal to Nicholson by stating that he would not mind a partial mobilization, say at Odessa or Kiev, but could not view indifferently a mobilization on the German frontier. Geographical concerns were top of Lichnowsky's agenda, and he noted that if this mobilization took place on the German frontier, Germany would be compelled to mobilize, and France would naturally follow suit. This would, of course, bring about a war, so he requested that Britain do everything in its power to scale down the tensions and urge the Russian government not to mobilize. Nicholson listened to Lichnowsky's qualms in full, but politely dismissed them once the German ambassador had finished. "I told Prince Lichnowsky," he later told Grey, "that we had no information as to a general mobilization, or indeed of any mobilization immediately." Nicholson then claimed, as though he was stating a fact, that the order mobilizing 1.1 million men has not been issued. In fact, Nicholson was in a way correct. No official communique announcing the mobilization had been directed, either to local or national government. However, since this was the period preparatory to war, such orders were not issued, and the whole point was to carry on in secrecy. After denying German facts, Nicholson told Lichnowsky that Britain would be unable to order or request Russia cease its activities either way, since doing so would be difficult and delicate for us. When Austria was...
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Contemplating such a measure, we should not be listened to. Nicholson insisted also that it wasn't mobilization, but actual conflict that was of his concern, and that the issue was to prevent, if possible, active military operations. Nicholson then told Lichnowsky of the planned four-power conference, due to mediate between the three interested parties, ignoring the facts both that France and Russia remained opposed to it, and Germany had already expressed its own wishes for a different form of mediation. In short, Arthur Nicholson had done an unfortunate job filling in for Grey. He had managed to offend German sensibilities on four areas. First, there was the blanket refusal to listen to or believe German protests about mobilization, which Grey could have gathered to hold some water had he bothered to talk to his Russian ambassador. Second, Nicholson claimed that London couldn't restrain St. Petersburg, even though Britain was meant to be a neutral party in the event. Third, he came to the conclusion that, even if Russia was mobilizing, only actual military measures were of a concern to Britain in any case, since only they threatened the peace. This is despite just being told of the chain reaction that would ensue if Berlin discovered Russia was mobilizing against her and felt the need to reciprocate. Fourth, and finally, by introducing Arthur Nicholson's new four-power proposal to mediate between the three powers of Russia, Serbia, and Austria equally, Britain would put Germany in an awkward position, whereby she would face the pressure of the Entente and the undisguised antagonism of Italy during the negotiations. Far from coming away with a positive message, Lichnowsky must have wondered at the extent of British neutrality. Indeed, Nicholson had done a shocking job representing his country to Berlin. But Lichnowsky seemed initially to agree with the proposals, for fear that rejection would cause a breach between England and Germany, which the raging Anglophile Lichnowsky viewed with horror. But Lichnowsky's Anglophile tendencies were not shared wholly in Berlin, and many were incredulous there at the news that London seemed unaware of what Russia was doing. Reports from St. Petersburg about Portelet's short meeting with Sazonov arrived in pieces over the course of the day, along with the German ambassador's conversations with his Austrian colleague in Russia that had brought him up to speed. Speaking of speed, such an issue remained paramount for the Germans. They believed that the only way to act against Serbia was to do so with haste, that Vienna should strike against Belgrade so rapidly and defeat it so quickly that countermeasures would be irrelevant and pointless. And yet, such a view was gradually being eroded by news of Russian activities. Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs in Germany, Gottlieb von Jagow, had sent a circular letter on the 18th of July reflecting German policy when dealing with Russia. "The more boldness Austria displays, the more strongly we support her, the more likely Russia is to keep quiet." Jagow had met with the Austrian ambassador on Saturday the 25th of July in Berlin, and picked his brains by inquiring whether Serbian refusal would be followed by an immediate declaration of war, and further warned that any delay in the commencement of military operations would bring the danger of intervention by outside powers. Jagow told the Austrian ambassador to present the world with a fait accompli. Jagow wanted Austria to move before Russia had the chance to respond, and to end the issue while St. Petersburg debated action. This would be an open and shut case, which would, because of its speed, prevent Russian participation. But Jagow should have known by now that he was not dealing with statesmen who valued speed above all else. On Sunday afternoon, today 100 years ago, Berchtold summoned the Chief of Staff Conrad von Hotzendorf, along with the German Ambassador to Vienna, Count Chertsky. Chertsky urged speed and fell in line with the policy of his government, and Berchtold also agreed. The two then turned to the bellicose Conrad, whose repeated calls for a smashing of Serbia seemed to suggest a desire to immediately destroy Serbia as soon as possible. But Conrad shocked them both. When Berchtold asked Conrad, "When do you want the declaration of war?" Conrad replied that war would be needed only at the stage when operations could begin at once, the 12th of August. It seemed as though Austria was doing it again. After delaying for an unbearable length of time, then managing to leak the details of their plans, then having their ultimatum rejected, Vienna's official policy now seemed to be yet another period of waiting and seeing as the country took 2 weeks to mobilize. In many ways, though, this actually made sense. Why would Austria attack Serbia before it was militarily ready? It could not have mobilized earlier, thanks to the harvest leave issue and the machinations of Stefan Tisa, the Hungarian minister-president. Berchtold in vain lamented that Austria couldn't wait 2 weeks, as the diplomatic situation will not hold that long. Russia, by 2 weeks' time, would be more than prepared for whatever response she needed to take, especially if the substantial rumours that she had already been mobilising were true. The German plan of a swift attack would thus be foiled again, as it had been in the days after the assassination. There would be no fait accompli, but because Berchtold didn't want to disappoint the Germans again, he claimed that Austria would not declare war yet, but that she might do so soon if Serbia became hostile. Had Berchtold known of Sazonov's promising discussion with his ambassador that took place simultaneously in St. Petersburg while he had met with Konrad and the German ambassador, then he may have had even more reason not to press ahead with a swift answer to the ultimatum. However, word of Zaporizhzhia's conversation with Sazonov would not be received until that night, and Sazonov's report of the encounter, sent to his own ambassador in Vienna, would similarly not reach Berchtold until Monday morning. This Russian ambassador in Vienna, meanwhile, had been reporting on Austria-Hungary's own mobilization against Serbia. These preparations were largely similar to Russia's period preparatory to war, despite the fact that Konrad had made clear that the actual war was only going to come on the 12th of August. Whether Berchtold wanted to listen to the reports Zaporizhzhia sent back to Vienna or not, and whether he would have actually wanted to modify the terms of the ultimatum to please and defuse Russia, events were gradually being overtaken by the preparations made by both sides, which suggested that more sinister intentions were coming to the fore. The French liaison officer at Russian military headquarters had reported back to the war ministry in Paris that yesterday the war minister confirmed to me the mobilization of the army corps of the military districts of Kiev, Odessa, Kazan and Moscow. The endeavour is to avoid any measure likely to be regarded as directed against Germany. But nevertheless, the military districts of Warsaw, Vilna and St. Petersburg are secretly making preparations. The cities and governments of St. Petersburg and Moscow are declared to be under martial law. The Minister of War has reiterated to us his determination to leave to Germany the eventual initiative of an attack on Russia. German and Austrian intelligence, of course, could not be sure of Russian measures to the same degree as the French, but the evidence was nonetheless substantial enough for Ambassador Portelet to feel the need to confront Sazonov about it in his office. Despite their early morning conversation that had seemed to dispel some of the German doubts, Portelet wanted to hear it from the horse's mouth, that Russian plans were not as total as believed. He arrived in Sazonov's office at 9 p.m., and his account of the conversation the two had was revealing insofar as it demonstrates what Sazonov wanted to hide as much as what he felt willing to tell. Portelet complained to Sazonov about the news widely reported among the circles of foreign military attachés, according to which several Russian army corps have been sent towards the western border in accordance with the mobilization directive. Sazonov responded, Portelet said, by saying that he could guarantee that no mobilization order had been given, and that none could be expected until Austria-Hungary undertake hostile measures against Russia. Again, Sazonov was making use of a technicality, though it is unlikely that he would have had any qualms about lying, since he was a politician and statesman after all, just like Sir Arthur Nicholson had stated earlier, an order for mobilization had not yet taken place. In other words, the kind of public, traditional method of announcing across the state that the process of mobilization was henceforth underway did not take place. What happened instead was a quiet directive signed by the Tsar that ensured mobilization in all but name would take place behind the curtain put up by the period preparatory to war. The period preparatory to war, if one recalls, contained as one of its instructions the note to lull the enemy to sleep through the use of diplomatic trickery. With the period preparatory to war underway, it is not hard to see the common features in the description given of the directive and the policies now adopted by Sazonov. Sazonov concluded with the claim that certain military measures were underway, perhaps to ease the Germans' mind that, of course, some operations were being conducted, but nothing like the kind of mobilization that Russia seemed to be suspected of. But Sazonov wasn't the only one who was willing to bend the truth. When the war minister called in Major Egling, the German military attaché, to try and ease his nerves, the conversation was just as sneaky. At the same time as the German ambassador talked to Sazonov, the war minister offered Egling his word of honour that no mobilisation order had yet been issued. While certain preparations were underway, the war minister admitted, he insisted that not a horse was being requisitioned nor a reservist called up. Both of these points being total lies, since the period preparatory to war required both of these items. When Major Egling reported home to the German Chief of Staff von Moltke, he noted the atmosphere. I got the impression of great nervousness and anxiety. I consider the wish for peace genuine, military statements so far correct, that complete mobilization has probably not been ordered, but preparatory measures are very far-reaching. Egling concluded that the Russians are evidently striving to gain time for new negotiations and for continuing their armaments. The problem was, time was the last thing Germany had. As more time lapsed, it looked more and more unlikely that Austria would be able to settle its accounts with Serbia alone. Additionally, with Russia perhaps mobilizing itself against Austria, Berlin's own war plans would soon be in jeopardy if it did not move fast. Reflecting the mood at the time, but against the wishes of the German Chancellor, who did not wish to give the impression that Germany was preparing itself for war, Germany's Kaiser, its military chief of staff, and its naval secretary were all on their way back to Berlin from extended summer vacations. With the presence of so many military minds soon to be in the capital, Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg likely reckoned that their return would mark a point from which the tensions of Europe would only increase.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.